When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com.
Welcome to the Project Upland podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting. We plan to take you into some of our favorite bird covers as we talk to the people that hunt them and the organizations that support them. We'll also break down the dogs, guns, and gear used to pursue them, and of course, we'll share the stories that celebrate this American tradition.
It's one of those things that you do that feels timeless.
My dad brought home our first Brittany when I was about 10 years old.
The red gods are calling, and I must go.
These are your stories.
You're tuned into the Project Upland podcast. I'm your host, Nick Larson. Welcome to the show for episode number 63. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by our friends at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp, the finest rough grouse and woodcock hunting experience located in northern Minnesota. You haven't experienced grouse camp until you've experienced it at Pine Ridge. And by Dogtra Callers. Dogtra brings you a full line of top quality, super functional dog training and handling products for some of the best collars on the market. This month we are talking about the 1900S. Fully waterproof receiver and transmitter, water-resistant hands-free remote controller, ergonomic receiver design, perfect training collar, 127 stimulation level rheostat dial, another great collar from Dogtra. Find out more about that collar and more by visiting dogtra.com. And by Yukonuba Premium Performance Dog Food. Out in the field, how you prepare determines how you'll perform. With balanced fat and protein to support peak condition in your bird dog, Yukonuba Premium Performance Dog Food enhances strength, energy, and endurance. So when that tailgate finally drops, you and your dogs are ready for anything. Strong, focused, ready for anything. That is a Yukonuba dog. And by Gordy and Sons Outfitters, when your boots have the proper tread, you never notice how slippery it is. When your hunting jacket features the right liner, your body temperature won't enter your mind. When your shooting vest allows total freedom of movement, you won't think twice before swinging through that quail. At Gordy and Sons, they want you to focus solely on the hunt, not the performance of your gear. And that's why the Gordy family has personally curated the best-in-class gear from around the globe for their store. Learn more about them and check out that awesome gear at GordyandSons.com. And by Dakota 283 Kennels. Kennels built to last a lifetime. One-piece rotomold design, frame steel door, rock-solid kennel, great size and weight. Everything you and your dog need for a safe and comfortable hunting trip. Check out Dakota283.com. Look at their kennels. If you buy one, use the promo code PU50DD for 50% off of a Dash product with purchase of a kennel, and always free shipping from Dakota283.com. This week's winner of the podcast giveaway, Kyle Alexander. Kyle left us a review in the iTunes app. We appreciate that very much. Anybody out there listening could be next week's winner of the podcast giveaway. All you have to do is make a meaningful contribution to this show, leave the podcast a rating, leave us a review just like Kyle did, subscribe to the podcast, share the podcast, send us a feedback or a guest suggestion. We appreciate it, and we love to hear from our listeners. Send me an email at nick.larson@northwoodscollective.com. Only one special announcement today, just a reminder of the Films of the Feathered out there in Lander, Wyoming on June 14th, presented by the Wyoming Wildlife Federation. I'm going to be there along with a bunch of other cool people. Ron Maim, Tyler Webster, JC Bosch is going to be there. I can't wait. It's going to be an awesome event. I got some details from the Wyoming Wildlife Federation yesterday. I am super excited to make the trip out to Lander, Wyoming in June, and I hope to see and meet some of you there. Go to wyomingwildlife.org and look for Films of the Feathered for more event details. All right, here we go. Today's show, it's a good one, like they always are. At least I hope that. And from most of what we hear from the listeners, we know that you appreciate the Project Upland podcast. We appreciate you listening, and we enjoy bringing it to you. This one was especially enjoyable. I got to make a trip down to the headquarters of our guest today. They're local, right here in Minnesota. I'd never been there before. It was awesome. I took a tour of the factory and afterwards sat down with three employees of the company, and we chatted all about their business, their products, stuff that I think is probably going to interest the shotgunner slash upland hunting bird enthusiast. Last week, I went to Federal Ammunition, and my guests today are Ryan Bronson, Dan Compton, and Adam Moser. And a special thanks to my tour guide, Jared Hinton. He didn't join us on the podcast today, but you will be hearing more from him. You'll be hearing more from Jared later this fall as we have a Project Upland slash Federal hunting trip planned in September. Going west. It's going to be awesome. You're going to see and hear all about it. I'm looking forward to that. But today, the focus is Federal Ammunition. The story of Federal goes a little something like this. Technology is the lifeblood of Federal Ammunition, and it's been pumping through their culture since 1922. That's when founding president Charles L. Horn started a culture of innovation that has guided everything they've done for nearly a century, turning a company that began humbly in Anoka, Minnesota, into one of the world's largest producers of sporting ammunition. I imagine most people listening to this are familiar with Federal Ammunition. I consider it a household name, but again, I've been in the outdoors hunting most of my life. If you haven't heard of Federal, I think you're going to learn a lot today. If you have, I think you will know more about Federal at the end of this podcast than you did before we started. I had a blast. The guys from Federal were great. We got into the weeds. We nerded out on shotgun shells, shots, patterns, all kinds of fun stuff that I think you're going to love. So let's get into today's show. And welcome to the Project Upland podcast from Federal Ammunition, Ryan Bronson, Dan Compton, and Adam Moser. And we're live. What's up, everybody? Nick Larson with the Project Upland podcast, and we are live and on location at Federal Ammunition headquarters. I just got done touring the facility thanks to my tour guide, Jared, who will not be joining us on the podcast today, but he is in the room making sure everybody stays in line. So, Jared, thank you for giving me a tour of the facility. I saw a lot of cool stuff today. But Jared has welcomed three additional people from Federal into the room and onto the podcast for the Project Upland listeners. Very excited to have a chat with these gentlemen today. And we're going to start to my left with intros, name, occupation, what you do for Federal, all that fun stuff.
Sure. I'm Dan Compton. I'm the product line manager for Shot Shell and Rimfire Ammunition. So product line manager typically means anything product related in the portfolio. So pricing, intro, bringing new products to market, what old products go away, and cover shot shell, rimfire, muzzle loading, and primers.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm Adam Moser, product engineering manager for Shot Shell and Rimfire. So we own the designs of the new products, the existing products, and sustaining those products in the factory.
I'm Ryan Bronson. I'm the Director of Conservation and Public Policy for Federal and also the bigger corporation, Vista Outdoor. Been with the company for 13 years. I work on state government relations and manage our outreach programs to youth and women and all the organizations trying to get more people into our sport and try to legalize number 7 shot and number 9 shot all over the country for turkey hunting. Those are the kinds of things we do.
that's kind of been in the news lately. What's going on with that?
Well, these guys came up with a new product here in the last couple of years, tungsten super shot in our turkey loads. It's ultra dense shot. And because it's so dense, we can use shot sizes that are much smaller than what we traditionally had. And a lot of states for a long time had turkey regulations where you could only shoot number 4, 5, and 6 shot. That's what a traditional turkey load was. But that was all based around lead ammunition. So using this tungsten ultra-dense shot, we have states that have troubles getting their heads around the idea that you can go out and shoot 9 shot, which they think of as, you know, something you use for skeet, but it'll kill a turkey dead as heck at 60 yards. I work with states and sometimes the legislature, sometimes the wildlife agency, and try to get them to change their regulations to kind of catch up with the times. Let us bring another non-lead product to market, but frankly, just bring a really effective turkey load that, heck, we can make 410s into turkey loads these days because of that. Some great engineering. So we're just working with states to kind of get caught up to the modern times.
Yeah. Kind of that classic case of laws being developed in a previous era, and mm-hmm. obviously technology and innovation advancing. This is not the Morning Thunder Hunt podcast. This is the Project mm-hmm. Upland podcast. But I don't feel bad talking about turkeys a little bit just because we don't have a Morning Thunder Hunt podcast yet. And I did shoot my first turkey probably 10 days ago.
Oh, yeah.
Using Federal Shot. I don't know what JJ asked me what it was, but I borrowed some 5-shot Federal load from a buddy of mine, and it worked. I killed my first turkey. Adam, were you involved in the development of TSS?
Yeah. So that was a program we started 2 years ago, roughly, 2 years ago. With the notion of getting the turkey hunter the most effective product possible on the market. So we had a tungsten offering. It was a 15 density tungsten. We knew the hand loaders were playing with this 18 density product, essentially the densest shot you can get in tungsten. So we started out with the task of putting the most pellets on a turkey target as possible. And I think we did a pretty effective job of that. It lent us into going, you know, smaller, as Ryan alluded to. The smallest we had offered was 7 shot. But because we jumped up in density to that 18 grams per cc, we decided to start using 9 shot and exploring those options and smaller payloads, high pellet counts, low recoil, a bunch of different offerings for the consumer. So it's a great product to work on and super, super effective.
So the factors that are driving the innovation to go to a smaller shot is because you can maintain the density, maintain the energy delivery.
Correct.
And then you can increase pattern density.
Yep. So by going to a more dense material, you then will get, obviously, besides more energy downrange, more maintained velocity downrange, you're allowed to decrease the size of the pellet because the mass stays up with the higher density material. And the smaller that pellet is, the more you'll get into that payload.
Okay. So I have to ask the question. I know that TSS, it's a premium product, premium shot. So it's obviously more expensive. And when you're talking turkey hunting, you know, you're not shooting as much as say an upland bird hunter, but mm-hmm. or I imagine you guys look at all possibilities and you're always looking to innovate. I mean, are there applications for this in the upland hunting world at some point in the future? I mean, it's obviously very effective.
Yeah, potentially there would be. It would just depend on how much are you willing to pay for it.
Correct.
You know, it's tungsten is very expensive.
Yeah.
The market price on lead, you can buy a 25-pound bag of shot for about $1.20 a pound. Tungsten, you're going to pay $40 a pound.
Sure.
So that translates directly into what it costs per shot when you get out into the field. Turkey hunters, you know, don't shoot very often, so they're willing to accept some. But yeah, there's a potential for it. We have a new offering coming in that's kind of pretty cool. Our Federal called the Custom Shop, where you take a certain product like that, where maybe it's not, you know, for the mass market, but you have hunters who want 28 gauge and less recoil and want to be able to reach out and touch a little further for grouse or quail. And we'll take a smaller volume item like that, run it through the custom shop, basically hand load you the amount you're looking for and send it off to you. So yeah. It's pretty cool coming around the corner for us.
Now that the custom shop, that is something that Jared and JJ and I talked about a little bit before this, and that's very unique. Obviously, that's something new for Federal. I think that is that's going to be of interest to a lot of people that are, you know, maybe shooting a gauge, 16 gauge, 28 yeah. gauge, something that's not as common. You're looking for the exact load and shot you want, and that's not open yet, but it's coming possibly later this year.
Yeah, the plan is to be midsummer. We'll see if that gets pushed out a little bit, but for the most part, we're planning midsummer. And on the shot shell side, we're doing, you know, for the most part, it's all TSS tungsten loads.
Sure.
Stuff that we don't have mainline right now. But phase two, phase three going out, what I think what we envision is, you know, maybe potential for bismuth or other things that might be niche or double gun loads that are softer. And just, you know, we're going to ultimately let the consumer tell us once sure. we open the door and we start getting the orders, we're like, hey, can you do this? Can you do that? And we're going to take that feedback and hopefully be able to roll with it. And then there's a centerfire rifle component to that as well, where there's cartridges we don't offer today, but we'll do that on a smaller scale. And then potentially certain bullets that we might load in 30-06, but we don't load certain bullet from somebody else. We'll do that on a hand load scale for them.
Sure. Too. Okay. So yeah, I mean, obviously you can see that works really well for you guys because you're selling product, but you're also doing market research at the same mm-hmm. time. Like you said, letting your customers determine, you know, where the demand is, what yeah. they're looking for, and maybe get a new product idea out of it.
Yeah, as a product line guy, I'm excited for it because sure. we can kind of pilot something. And if the reception's overwhelming and the scale needs to be risen, we can plug that into the facility and go through the standard, you know, process, which is designed for higher volume and higher lot runs. But yeah, you'll get that hand loaded touch from couple guys down in ballistics lab who will make it for you, put a sticker on it, and send it out the door.
That's pretty cool. I mean, that is one thing that I had the benefit of seeing today, you know, coming down here to the facility, having Jared walk me around, being able to see the shells, the cartridges, everything being made. And I mean, one thing that JJ pointed out that is somewhat unique to Federal, you're taking raw materials and you're ending up with finished products, which doesn't necessarily happen with every company, but you know, seeing the big pallets and ignits of lead and the silos that have the plastic in it that become shotgun hulls, I mean, just being able to see that kind of stuff and see it on such a scale, you know, was very cool. Obviously, you know, I'm a consumer. I walk into the store and I see the shelves full of shotgun shells, but you might not think at the time that where it comes from, and it's right here in Minnesota, which obviously I'm biased. It's my home state, but I will never walk in and pick up a box of Federal shells and not think of this tour. So that was obviously neat. I wish everybody listening to this could have gone on the tour, but maybe someday they'll get that pleasure. Ryan, before we get too much further, I'd love to share a little bit of the history of Federal. Obviously today they're owned by Vista Outdoors. Mm-hmm. And right. and so you can talk about that relationship a little bit, but definitely let's get some history, because I think many people listening to this are going to be familiar with Federal Ammunition, but let's put some background there.
Well, so the history for the company goes back to 1922. That was the year that the company was founded. And at the time, they only built shotgun shells. And they were right here in Anoka, Minnesota, where they built the factory. The founder was Charles Horn. And the funny thing was, the original owner of the company was the Olin Foundation. And people know Olin as the company that owns Winchester. So this was their private charitable foundation that actually owned a competitor. Ended up becoming a competitor, and now we're bigger than Winchester, 100 years later. So that was how it got started, building shot shell. When you think about that era, 1922, wildlife populations were near all-time lows. So it was a funny time to start as a new product, because what drove the ammunition market at the time was hunting. That was the number one use. Today, recreational shooting is so much bigger, but at the time, hunting was a big part of it. And that really played a big factor in the early philosophy of the company, and it's carried on till today, where conservation was a real priority. So beginning 15 years into the company's tenure, the Pittman-Robertson Act passed, and Federal, as a young company, was lobbying for and supporting that act to help fund wildlife conservation, and started the 4-H conservation camps back then. And so we've been working with 4-H since 1937 as well, on the conservation side. And so the company progressed and got through the 50s and 60s and started loading centerfire rifle ammunition, 22 ammunition, and today we build everything. We're the complete line, rimfire, centerfire, and shot shell, and we're all here in Anoka, Minnesota, one factory. We don't have a bunch of factories all over the country. We've got our sister company, CCI and Spear, which is out in Lewiston, Idaho. But everything that's federal is right here in Anoka, Minnesota. So that's pretty cool. We have grown a lot over that time. You know, originally there were a couple of dozen employees. Today we've got about 1,500 people that are working here. For a long part of the history of the company, we worked 8-hour days, 3 shifts a day, but we're closed on the weekends. And for more than a decade, probably going on close to 20 years, we've been a 24-hour operation. So this factory never closes except at Christmas, and it's operating 24/7. We saw that, you know, in the four years ago, and you know, for about a decade there, where we couldn't build ammunition fast enough. I mean, we were expanding and adding and doing everything we can. But so the company has been, we're coming up on our 100th anniversary in 2022. We're very proud of that, and well, I think you'll see a lot of celebrations. But we've got a whole bunch of innovations that Federal is responsible for. Color coded shot shells is an invention that we came up
really?
With, and that was all because back in the old days, every shotgun shell was red, and it was easy to put a 20 gauge down a 12 gauge, and it would get far enough down where you'd get a 2012 burst. And so by color coding shotgun shells, we've made it immensely safer. Everyone has their color codes for their 12 gauge loads, but you know, the whole industry standard, everything's yellow. That has improved safety for the consumer a lot. That was one of our innovations. We've got the best primers in the market. The way that we build primers is different than everyone else, and that's why we've got such innovative and effective and hot primers that is an industry standard. So there's a whole bunch of things that over time we've gotten really good at, and I think we're pretty proud of our history, even though we're the youngest of the ammunition companies. Winchester and Remington are older. There's a couple of upstarts out in Nebraska that are a little bit younger, but we've grown, and we are now the largest commercial ammunition manufacturer in the world.
That was absolutely on display as I walked around the factory. Now, I've never been to another ammunition factory, so I have nothing to compare to, but I just know that every time we walked around the corner, there was another expansive, you know, warehouse section and different work cells and, you know, people hard at work making ammunition. I mean, there's casings and hulls and stuff going everywhere. It was pretty wild. Educate myself a little bit and the listeners with respect to Pittman Robinson, the tax that is on basically shooting sports ammunition, guns, everything to help wildlife conservation, many other things. Is it paid by federal, or would it be paid by the people that are buying ammunition from you?
It depends on how you look at it. The check is written by us. Okay. So every quarter we write a check. And together with our other ammunition companies and our sister company, Savage Arms, we have been averaging as a company, Vista Outdoor, we've been averaging $80 million a year that we pay in Pittman Robertson taxes. That's a tax that every ammunition manufacturer has to pay, every firearm manufacturer has to pay, every archery company has to pay. And it's not any other products. So a lot of times when people talk about Pittman Robertson, they think any hunting product pays that tax, and that's not true. Guns, ammo, archery gear, those are the only products that have that tax on it. And that is the biggest funder of conservation funding in the country. It comes from Pittman Robertson. But it's an 11% tax. It's assessed on the manufacturer. So we have to write We have to write a check to the IRS every quarter for what we sold that quarter, what we built and sold. And then the IRS turns it over to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a formula where they allocate it to the states based on how big the state is and how many hunting licenses they sell. And then the states can only use it for certain things. They can use it for wildlife management, so it can pay for the population monitoring and things like that. It can pay for habitat projects that are for wildlife and publicly accessible for hunters. It pays for hunter education, and it can pay for shooting range expansion. And we recently got some legislation through Congress, the shooting range bill, that's going to enable states to be more flexible with their funding to build more shooting ranges. And one of the things we've seen with like youth clay shooting programs is we're running out of capacity for places to shoot clay pigeons, you know, on a Wednesday night after school for team practice. And so that's really important. Pittman Robertson helps contribute to all of those things. It dwarfs the Land and Water Conservation Fund. It dwarfs almost every other source of funding out there short of the Conservation Reserve Program for putting dollars in the ground. And it's the underpinning for wildlife management in the country. So state wildlife agencies get their Pittman Robertson allocation every year. They're limited in what they can spend it on, and it has to be commingled with their hunting license dollars. And that actually protects the hunting license dollars from getting raided by state legislatures. Mm-hmm. Because if a state legislature tries to take, you know, deer license fees or pheasant stamp money for something else, the Fish and Wildlife Service can come and take the federal aid back. That's a really big stick that has really created a funding system in this country that I think hunters should be proud of. They need to know about it. A lot of hunters don't know about it. A lot of shooters don't know how much they're contributing to wildlife conservation right. as well. But it's been successful, it's sustainable, and it's really a model, I think, that the rest of the outdoor recreation world should try to emulate. People don't pay a tax on their Patagonia gear to go hiking, but they paid for their rifle, and they paid for their shotgun, and they paid for their shotgun shells. That's helping pay for conservation.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very well put, and I definitely learned a thing or two. I recall hearing about the shooting range bill, the legislation on an episode of the Mediator podcast. Mm-hmm. Would that have been, was the guy from the National Council for National Shooting Sports? I don't recall. I don't know if you heard it or not, but
yeah, I remember they did an episode. I don't remember who he had. Oh, yeah, it might have been Nephi Cole from National Shooting Sports Foundation that okay. was involved in that. But yeah, the Mediator has talked about it. It's been a high priority for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is our trade group that represents the gun and ammo manufacturers, because especially as we look at R3 issues. The endangered species that I think most of us are most concerned about for funding conservation for the future is hunters. And the critical habitat for hunters or shooters is shooting ranges. You can't practice with your shotgun in most places in this country unless you have a shooting range to go to. Rifle, pistol, whatever you're shooting, ranges are where people shoot their guns, become proficient, but it's also where they're generating the Pittman Robertson dollars that pays for wildlife conservation. So I think anything we can do to promote more shooting ranges is good for wildlife conservation. The two things are just, they're inextricably tied.
Yeah. That's the wildlife biologist coming out of you, drawing those parallels.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my salary used to come from Pittman Robertson when I worked for Minnesota DNR. So yeah, absolutely.
We'll keep you on the line here for another minute, Ryan. You know, talking about R3, and obviously I think as a Minnesotan, I have definitely seen the impact and the growth of the high school clay target shooting leagues, trap shooting, and see that as a real positive, you know, getting a lot of kids through those leagues, getting their gun safety done, getting proper, safe, good handling of a firearm. I mean, As a guy that's heavily invested in upland hunting and wanting to recruit people into upland hunting, you know, that's a talent pool that a lot of conservation organizations, Pheasant Forever, RGS, all of them are trying to figure out, you know, how do we tap that and how do we give those kids a direct avenue into hunting? As you say, you know, hunter numbers have been dwindling, and that's obviously a concern of all of ours and certainly of Federals. How do you guys involve yourself? Because I know you're involved. How do you involve yourself with that league and those initiatives?
So I'd mentioned that we've been involved with 4-H since the 30s, when we were involved with conservation camps. Beginning in the 1980s, the 4-H Shooting Sports Program became a national effort. And my predecessor here at Federal was a gentleman by the name of Bill Stevens. I grew up here in Minnesota as well, wildlife biologist from the University of Minnesota. He helped found together with the NRA and some other industry leaders the 4-H Shooting Sports Program, which really is kind of a precursor to what we're seeing today, where it's a organization built through 4-H all over the country where kids are learning the different shooting sports disciplines, and 300,000 kids shoot in that program a year, and a lot of people don't know about it. The high school clay target program here started here in Minnesota, but it's expanded to a lot of places. It's taken it to the next level for those specific clay target sports, primarily trap. But the fact that it's gotten into high schools and it's helping build a system with teams where that mainstreams it. Because if you can earn a letter in trap shooting, that makes it a regular part of your life, and it that mainstreams it. That's such an important thing from a cultural standpoint. They're not the only youth shooting sports program out there. The Scholastic Clay Target program and ATA, the Amateur Trap Shooters Association, has their AIM program. There's a lot of them out there, but the high school program has really caught the fire, I think, because it's school by school, mainstream, just like any other sport. I like the idea that, you know, growing up we talked about soccer moms, and today we've got trap shooting moms. You know, that's a great advent for our sport. And one of the things that's great about it is to participate in that program, you have to take hunter safety. You have to have your hunter ed card. Well, now you have taken two of the big hurdles to get into hunting, you know, and you've achieved those. Getting hunter ed certified that doesn't just happen. That takes work and effort.
Yep.
And then learning how to shoot a shotgun. Shooting sports skills are not skills that you pick up other places. And learning how to shoot at a trap range through that program, you've taken a lot of the big steps that's going to help you get to the next level. And I'm hoping that high school clay target programs, when a kid wants to take the weekend off and go duck hunting or go grouse hunting or go pheasant hunting, that they're not saying, no, you got to come to practice. And I believe that I get the sense that that's the culture, you know, that those participants, boys and girls, and the percentage of girls in the high school programs is much higher than it is in the general hunting population. That's an opportunity to recruit. So it gives me a lot of hope for the future. But whether they become hunters or not, when they're pulling the trigger on that trap range, they're paying Pittman Robertson taxes, which is helping fund wildlife agencies, which is helping make sure that there's birds out in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of positives to that. I mean, I certainly I wish that there was that when I was coming up through high school. I'm having to learn how to shoot at 33 years old,
but
I'm getting better at it, you know, year by year, little by little. But no, that is a very, very positive thing, and I knew that Federal was involved with it, and I imagine you will continue to be.
Yeah, the biggest thing that we do, we actually support the leagues and help support the shoots, but the biggest thing we do is we work with teams to get them discounted ammunition.
Yeah.
Just because we view that as an opportunity. It's like a coupon for the future. That if we can get kids, instead of going out and shooting one round a week, they shoot two rounds a week and get better, then we think that they'll be customers for life. And then they'll be going into Walmart and Cabela's and Shields and every other retailer in the country and buying shotguns and shotgun shells. Not just this year, but for the next 50 years, because shooting sports is a lifetime sport. You're just as likely to be doing it when you're 65 as when you're 15.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dan and Adam, you know, kind of bring you guys in here a little bit. I know well enough to know that upland hunting is not always the front and center of, driving the market, you know, with ammunition or guns or anything. But obviously, Federal cares about upland hunters. You make products for upland hunters. Talk a little bit about kind of what are the offerings for upland hunters aside from just somebody going in and grabbing a box of 7.5 shot 20 gauge.
To kind of frame that, like you say, it's not front and center, but how we look at products mm-hmm. and categories, you know, we divide it into, you got waterfowl hunting, you have big game hunting, you have upland hunting, you have turkey hunting. And then we look within that group and we say, what do we need to do to win there?
Yeah.
So we do try to focus on every area and have an offering. So that's kind of how we go about it. So it may not be the biggest, you know, like turkey hunting, not a lot of volume. It may not be the biggest, but we wanted to have the biggest, baddest shell, so we went after the TSS market. So sure. In upland, we've tried to do the same thing. Historically, the basic lead loads, and then that worked in the copper plated loads, buffered. That all went for a while. Did well for quite a long time. About 10 years ago, we launched Prairie Storm, which really is probably one of the most I don't know, strongest following of any load we have between Blacklaw and Prairie Storm. We have, we're probably one of the hardcore user groups that people keep coming back to it. We've worked the Pheasant Fest every year, and people just tell you how much they love Prairie Storm. Yep. So we've got that. So I guess my point is we kind of have something, everything under the sun, whether it's 28 gauge through 12 for upland hunting. We've got anything from your basic price point load all the way up to something premium like Prairie Storm. And then we're expanding a lot more into more lead-free offerings too, as well as we're seeing states and public lands go to that, and just conscientious hunters who are just choosing to go that road. Yep. As well. So.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, we've had some articles on non-tox, lead-free, alternative shot, whatever you want to call it. We've had that on Project Upland, and we see responses, you know, basically on both ends of the spectrum. But the reality is there are absolutely people, I know I hunt with some of them, that are choosing to hunt with a lead-free shot because they want to. And obviously the increase in options and availability is a good thing as a consumer. And so I was paging through the new product guide for 2019 Federal. And one of those is Upland Steel. That's a new load.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we have. So we've had Steel in the lineup, you know, for quite a while. A lot of what we offered for a long time was, here's a duck hunting load and go ahead and use that and shoot that at Upland Birds. So with products like Upland Steel or Prairie Storm, so we try to make something a little more catered to the use. And interesting about Prairie Storm Steel, a lot of people aren't aware that we make it, but we do. But the design behind that was by offering 3 and 4 shot at 1600 feet per second, it was the equivalent of that number 5 lead load you shot at 1330 in terms of lead and in terms of energy you put down. So those are the things we try to put into it. But we realized that steel does cost a little bit more, you know, in terms of loaded ammunition. So Upland Steel is more of a price point product that we tried to get on the market. For one, to be competitive with some of our competitors, but also you don't always maintain the same performance as you do with lead when you go to a non-lead alternative because of the density part that Adam was talking about. So what can we do to still give you a good pattern and then you don't have to break the bank to go out because you're probably going to shoot more than your average, you know, hunter does when you go out in upland hunt. So Upland Steel is 20 gauge, 12 gauge offerings in 6 and 7.5, which is a true 7.5. So you can take that to a lot of trap ranges and shoot as well. We were pretty conscientious of that if you want to take a sporting clay shooting or whatnot. And then it just help not break the pocketbook as much.
Sure. Yeah. So. Adam, I wonder, could you walk us through a little bit, you know, when we pick up a box of shotgun shells, we've got the classic, you know, whether it's 2 3/4, you got shot size, you got velocity. Can you kind of just walk through that a little bit and kind of just give us the high level and how they relate to each other?
Sure. So obviously you're going to have your designation for gauge. Depending on what shotgun you're shooting, you're going to have your payload weight in ounces, usually is what people will recognize that in, whether it's a 1 ounce, an ounce and an eighth, ounce and a quarter, velocity and shot size. So when you're looking for maybe an upland application, you're probably looking in that around an ounce and an eighth or 1 ounce loads. But really, you know, the velocity aspect is driven by that payload weight. So as loads begin to come heavier and heavier, the velocity will typically decrease a little bit just because we are limited in how much pressure we can generate within that gun chamber. So as you get to these really big, heavy hitting loads, they tend to come down a little bit in velocity. So, you know, we can push a 1 ounce at, you know, 1350 or 1450, whereas if you get up into those ounce and a halves or those real big magnum loads, you will see that velocity come down. But, you know, depending on what you're going after, you know, what you're hunting, that will dictate your shot size. If you're after, you know, grouse versus a pheasant, you're gonna pick the applicable shot size. So maybe a 5 versus a 7.5 in lead loads. So you have to go to the store with your intent in mind of what you're gonna be after and then pick your loads accordingly.
And so as we're talking about, you know, potentially people making the choice to start shooting a lead-free ammunition, what are they're used to their standard lead load, they're going to go to steel. What should they be thinking about as far as shot size and velocity?
Yeah, good question. So kind of the rule of thumb that we use to tell the consumer is if you're used to shooting lead, go 2 shot sizes bigger into steel to get, you know, comparable energy and velocities and knockdown power. So if you're used to shooting a 6, you know, maybe go down to a 4 in a steel. So that'll be, as a general rule of thumb, a good thing to follow.
Okay. And then I know in this, in the Upland steel load, you are offering a 7.5 shot, but it's also kicked up to a higher velocity. So you're maintaining a little bit of that energy.
Yeah. So we compensate for that loss in density with the increased velocity. So as everybody knows, the kinetic energy is based on the velocity and the mass of the shot. So as that mass of that shot goes down, we have to kick that velocity up to get that energy downrange.
And steel being less dense, it's going to slow down quicker.
Correct.
Right. But what kind of, you know, like where is that velocity measurement taken? Is it right at the barrel or is it?
Yeah.
Don't they do it differently in Europe? I think I heard that somewhere.
So the muzzle velocity per SAMI definition is measured at 3 feet from the muzzle. Okay. So when we're building these loads in the factory and testing them, that standard measurement is chronographs are set out and that center point is at 3 feet from the muzzle.
Okay. And so again, steel slowing down quicker, is it on like a rising scale? Is it slowing down faster and faster as it gets further away, or is it more of a straight line decrease?
It would be more parabolic, I guess, as it starts to decay. That line, it's not a linear line of decay, I would say. I guess it becomes somewhat parabolic in its decay. But
okay.
The analogy I try to give people to think about, you know, shot comparison is think of a ping pong ball and think of a golf ball. Yep. They're both about the same diameter, both about the same size. Think of the ping pong ball as being the lighter material like steel and the golf ball being lead or something else. And just think how they perform. Think about how when you throw them, you know, what they do, you know, or when you hit them. Mm-hmm. That's a way to help get, though that's an extreme comparison.
Correct. Right? Yeah. Correct.
But it's a way to help get that concept in your mind.
Yeah, I use tennis balls and baseballs all the time.
There you go.
It's kind of the same. You can both throw them pretty decently, you know, but the baseball is just going to carry its energy further.
Yep.
So that's kind of, I've used that with lead and tungsten all the time.
Yeah, that's a great way to help people visualize what's going on. I mean, you know, is there, as far as effective range of steel, I mean, you guys look into that. I mean, is there...
Yeah, it's definitely considered. You know, we have different means of doing it, whether it's pellet energy calculations or physically going and shooting a block of ballistics gelatin and seeing how far it can penetrate at different yardages. Of course, pattern density comes into play too. You know, it may be able to penetrate a certain depth, but if it doesn't have a dense enough pattern with enough pellets on target, it's not going to matter how deep it penetrates. So all those factors are definitely considered. I mean, I don't know that we necessarily tell a consumer it's effective to this yardage and that's its max range, but we kind of know their capabilities.
So I'm going on the ping pong ball, golf ball, Ryan, here, and I'm thinking, is steel generally not as good of patterning for obvious reasons because it's lighter and it's going to flail around, or is that not the case?
Well, so there are different things you can do to combat the densities. I mean, on that same analogy, something that is heavier and denser will tend to fly more true. So I would say as a rule of thumb, steel could have the susceptibility to going off course a little bit easier than a more dense product would.
Sure.
But there are things we can do to the wad and things we can do to the shot to make sure it's, you know, as best as it can be and fly as true as possible. Of course, lead has a disadvantage that it deforms, so it's not perfectly spherical like steel is. And there's just different pros and cons to each one, but they're designed and loaded and built to be as effective as possible.
Yeah. So it's, but that answers my question really in that there are pros and cons to both. It's not a clear one versus the other. You know, that brings up another interesting question that I have, and kind of getting down to the weeds here, which I think is perfect because we got the right people in the room for it. There is a lot of tradition. I don't know if that's the right word, but as far as standard payload for a specific gauge, whether it's 3/4 ounce and a 28 gauge, 7/8 and a 20 ounce for 16 and an ounce and an eighth and 12 gauge. Mm-hmm. I have heard that a lot of that was sort of developed a long time ago, and today, most people that are buying shotgun ammunition know that you can buy, you know, I can go out and buy a 1 ounce in a 28 gauge. I have heard that, you know, modern ammunition sort of negates some of that old square load talk in theory. Can you talk about that a little bit as far as kind of like what has technology done for ammunition that allows you to create, you know, a higher payload in a,
sure,
a specific gauge.
Sure. Well, I mean, like everything, there's advancements. There's advancements in propellants. There's advancements in materials, in wads, in shot types. So as things progress and we get better and smarter and propellants that are capable of, you know, launching a 28 gauge at, you know, 1 ounce of 28 gauge at 1250, yep, you know, where you're not limited to that 3/4 ounce anymore. You mentioned square load. Mm-hmm. There is some truth in that, like efficiency wise on how well your shotgun patterns, the better you maintain, a smaller L over D so that your payload is about as tall as it is wide. It is patterns more efficiently. So if you think of a 410, very skinny, very tall, mm-hmm, shot column, tends to pattern less efficient than a 12 gauge 1 ounce load would, just on how many pellets are in that payload and how many hit the target when I shoot it. The 410 is generally not going to perform as well as a 12 gauge load. And we actually did a pretty fairly in-depth study for an article in Field and Stream a few years back that compared the bore diameter versus the pattern efficiency. And it was mostly directly linear in going from 410 up through 28, 20, 16, 12, 10. And that line of efficiency was almost right on par. So as those loads became, you know, not as tall and narrow, the L over D came down, the pattern efficiency went up. So
were in that article, were you shooting the same payload in each gauge?
We were trying to, you know, same shot size, same velocity, yep, and then standard payloads for those gauges. So whether that's a 11/16 in a 410 or a 1 1/8 ounce in a 12 gauge, we kind of picked the bread and butter for each gauge and compared them to each other.
Sure.
And I believe we even did it with, you know, lead and steel, to get that baseline.
Okay.
Yeah, I've looked at it. Like, you talk to hunters who shoot 10 gauge, mm-hmm, and they're like, I shoot the lights out every time I shoot 10 gauge. If you look at the payloads and velocities, it's not a lot different from a 12 gauge 3.5. You know, they're almost the same. And
right,
the 12 gauge 3.5 has pretty much crippled the 10 gauge forever because you can buy it in a 12 gauge and you can use it so much more diverse. But 10 gauge is patterned so much more efficiently. So you're not necessarily having more power.
Yep.
You're putting more pellets in a tighter space.
Yep.
You know, so, and a 410 kind of goes the other way. 410 is kind of right, hard to hit with because now you got a little more open pattern.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it, the way we try to explain what's going on to people is you've got this interaction of a bunch of pellets stacked on top of each other, and you've got a big force pushing these pellets. So as they come out of the barrel, you've got these spheres. If you think of a cue ball hitting a rack of a pool balls, the balls kind of go everywhere when you hit them. We kind of try to use that analogy and have people understand that you've got these forces pushing through these pellets, and when they come unreleased from the barrel, they kind of want to go in all different directions. Whereas you have, you know, a more of an even load, square load, they're kind of more uniformly pushing on each other, and you don't have as much of those outside pellets losing away from the pattern. So
yeah.
So based on the data, a 1 ounce 12 gauge load is more efficient than a 1 ounce 28 gauge load.
Correct. Yes. Exactly.
So I hear that a lot.
That breaks folks. My heart, Ryan. So
now I know a lot of people that are convinced that they shoot their 28 better than they shoot their 12, and they probably do.
Yeah.
They probably, mm-hmm, shoot because of recoil and other things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you shoot it, you know, look, we can do the science, but the shooter's got a lot of voodoo in there, and it's all between, yeah, their ears.
Yes.
And if you think that you're shooting it better, then shoot that.
Right.
Because if you think you're shooting it better, you will shoot it better. Because part of mm-hmm, shooting success is confidence and things. So we hear that a lot.
We paused this episode of the podcast for just a moment to let you know that today's show is also brought to you by Trinity Kennels, home of the Epanuel Breton. Trinity Kennels French Brittany Spaniels are from champion bloodlines, field-tested and family-approved for over 30 years. Coming from the most prestigious and elite French bloodlines as well as American champions, Trinity Kennels is committed to producing premier Epanuel Bretons for the field trialer and foot hunter alike. We now return to the Project Upland podcast.
So I think one of the things with the turkey loads, what I'm hearing hunters think more about is instead of just thinking in the raw ounces of shot, they're thinking about the number of pellets. Mm-hmm. Turkey hunters want to know that. I mean, if we've got a pellet if we've got a turkey load that doesn't have the same number of pellets that we say it should have, we will get calls from consumers who have cut open the shell and counted pellets, you know, without shooting it, or they've shot a target and counted holes in the target, and they'll know. I mean, we hear from those folks, and it's important. So the number of pellets in a payload is an important consideration, because a 1 ounce steel load and a 1 ounce lead load, if they're the same shot size, have drastically different pellet counts.
Yeah.
And the number of pellets is a big part of that.
Yeah, you'll actually see that on our website going forward, probably later in the year. That's one of the new fields we're going to put on there, is the number of pellets within a payload, because it is becoming such a common question.
And it shows. I will get people that will come up to me and tell me that, why aren't you saying how many dram equivalents that load is? I'm like, we said what the velocity is, which is a more relevant term. I mean, I can't explain to you exactly what a dram equivalent is. It's based on some English system from the 1600s or something.
Yeah, it is crazy. It's you know, the drams is a measurement of mass of propellant that it took to get that weight of payload to a certain velocity. So if you think of a 12 gauge, 1 1/8 ounce, 3 dram load, then people know, oh, that's 1200 feet per second. Well, we tell you it's 1200 feet per second. So what do you need that dram for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was based on older powders, I imagine, as well.
Yep. So I think primary black powder.
Yeah,
black powder. Because you had one choice, so it made a lot more sense. Yep. Burn rates on powders vary significantly. A lot of people are surprised that, well, and it's kind of intuitive if you're a hand loader, that there's more than one powder option for every recipe we have. And that helps us quite a bit in case we run out of a certain supply and there's a primary, but, you know, different powders rate. But just because switch you to different powder, now your grains is going to change because it's got different burn characteristics inside. Yep.
So. And we're loading to pressure and velocity.
Yeah,
absolutely. Because we might use 3 different powders for the same load based on what's available in the marketplace, because we're loading it by the millions.
Yep.
We're not using one can of powder for the next 6 years. And so we're loading, and that's a much more reliable thing to know, is, you know, pressure, velocity, pellet count.
Yep.
Those, because that's what, if those are the same every time, that means what's coming out of the end of your barrel is performing the same every time. And that's what we measure every day.
Another thing with different, with the gauges and just different materials too, is choke tubes have come an awful long way. And that, you know, it's something we take when we work on developing new loads, and the choke tube is one of the primary things. What are we going to test through now? And especially on sub gauge, to see more options in 28 gauge and 410 has been huge, because now, you know, maybe that 410 doesn't always pattern as efficiently through your standard full, but somebody's now creating something that's going to help that do better, you know, like Jebs or Rhino in a 410, you know, which is making it just shoot lights out, you know.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that was an interesting thing that I did pick up on the factory tour. You know, again, a lot of the stuff that Jared pointed out to me, very logical when you think about it, but you just wouldn't think about it being a consumer walking in a store. But Federal's buying so much powder that you're not necessarily getting the same exact powder every time. So just because that box that I'm buying at the store is the same thing that I'm used to buying, it could have slightly different ingredients, but that's the whole point of this facility here. The quality control and the testing that you're doing to make sure that you maintain those pressures, velocity, everything. I mean, there's a lot that goes into the box of shotgun shells that I'm putting in my vest.
Yeah, we don't think of it in how many grains of red dot is in that load. You know, we're thinking of the powder charge that's in there. What velocity is that generating? Is it within our spec, so that what's coming out of the end of the muzzle does the same thing with the box that we built today as the box that we built 10 years ago in the same load? That's what we want. We want repeatability. And so oftentimes, well, what's your recipe? Well, I mean, we've got a bunch of recipes. The important thing that you need to know is that what you buy today was the same as it was last year, and it'll be the same next year in that load.
Yeah, unless you guys say otherwise, you know, some kind of innovation. But yeah, that's the pellet count thing. I think that is a neat thing, and I'm happy to kind of know that we'll might see that going forward, because I think that's kind of like, you start, you know, 7/8 ounce a shot of 6-shot, you know, over time you sort of generally have an idea of what that is, but to actually see the pellet count number, that gives you a real idea of pattern density, especially if you get out like you should, and like nobody does enough, including myself, pattern your own shotgun, because there's, you know, you got to know what's coming out of the end of your barrel. But to know how many pellets there are and see what kind of density you're getting at a given range, I mean, that's obviously doing a lot of good for people to know what we're putting through them.
Yeah, we've always had a chart in our catalog, but you know, not everybody's got access to, sure, to the catalog. So I think it's good. You'll find in this day and age, consumers so much more, you know, educated than they ever have, and they have so many more tools, you know. But there's still a lot of room for us to give more and put more out there for them.
Yeah. So I guess possibly a question for you, Adam. I mean, what is, I guess it would be everybody, you know, whether it's consumer demand, but what is bringing, what is going to create a new offering for upland hunting from concept theory and bring it to market? I mean, what are those driving factors that would do it? Is it going to be technology? Is it going to be consumer demand? Probably a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of it starts with, well, kind of, that's part of my job. Sure. So in our role as product line manager, we're the voice of the customer, you know, so a lot of that comes from use. You know, we all try to get out in the field as much as we can.
Yeah.
If we hear things, you know, Ryan's really good about catching trends, you know, the media and our PR guys like Jared here, they feed us stuff all the time. Cause I kind of like the writers, cause they think outside the box a little bit, cause they're trying to be creative.
Sure.
You know, they're trying, what if we had this, and we get that an awful lot. So it's kind of putting all that together and then seeing where the product landscape is, and then you say, okay, there's that hole, there's that one thing we don't do, you know. And then I explain to people, our my relationship with Adam either goes two ways. It's either I go to him and say, hey, we can sell this, or we need this, can you develop it? Or they bring ideas to us and say, hey, we have this new technology, can you guys sell that? Yeah. And it goes both ways. And one of the, we have good relationships too, and we try to have a very open door to inventors that bring, mm-hmm, us ideas. You have a lot of people who come up with things, they just maybe don't have the scale or the equipment to test it out. So they'll bring us concepts, and then we'll help vet that, we'll help fund it. And a lot of the innovations you see in our catalogs come from those type of people. So mainly it starts with finding the need. Does it fit within our portfolio? Is it something that we think there's a good market for? And then I work with the development team like Adam, and, yep, and then they get very specific on their requirements. You, yep, know, so what are you looking for? Do you need it to, how tight do you need it to pattern? What gauges do we need to offer? What shot sizes do you need? What material do you need? And then what price point are we trying to go after? And, yep, then he takes the reins and runs with it after that.
Yeah. I'm going to backtrack a little bit on the subject of patterning. I know that you guys do some, and we've kind of talked about, you know, patterning is different in every gun, every, mm-hmm, gun, every choke, every load. I mean, we all owe it to ourselves to pattern our own shotguns with each kind of ammunition. What could we learn from the crew here at Federal about patterning, you know, whether, mm-hmm, it's tips, pointers, how can we do it better? What, sure, what do you guys look for?
Well, I guess from an industry standard, 40 yards is where we test at. That's kind of the norm. Sammy recognizes that. I guess the procedure is to shoot 10 rounds is what we do. I mean, I don't expect every consumer to do that, but we have the equipment and the facilities and the personnel to do it.
We're trying to sell ammo. So encourage them to shoot 10.
Always 10.
Yeah. But what it is measuring. So starting out with knowing how many pellets are in your shell,
okay,
shooting it at 40 yards onto a pattern board or a piece of paper or whatever you have available, and then assessing how many pellets hit the target in what we measure is a 30-inch circle. And within that 30-inch circle, what is my efficiency? So did 75% of my pellets fall in? Did 50%? Did 90%? So depending on the application and the choke, obviously, that's what we recommend. If you're going to be hunting, you know, grouse or something that's going to be, you know, a closer shot, you're going to want to, you know, maybe pattern at closer distances with more open chokes just to see what your pattern looks like, see what maybe your kill zone is, where you have holes. And then, but if you're hunting late season pheasants or something that's going to be, you know, flushing further away, you're going to want to constrict it down and shoot at further distances. So I guess that's our standard. You know, with turkey loads, though, we're doing something completely different. We're not necessarily focused on the 30-inch circle. That turkey guy wants to know what's in that 10-inch circle at 40 yards, so we're trying to put everything we can in a spot as small as possible. So two different objectives, I guess, two different products, and we test accordingly.
Yeah.
So one thing that I see with patterning is the typical way to pattern is you aim your shotgun at the patterning board, pull the trigger, and then not everybody mounts their gun and looks down that rib the same way they do is when they take the time and aim it.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that's absolutely a valuable thing to know with what your gun's, mm-hmm, capable of doing. But then when you're part of patterning, should be have the patterning board up, have yourself at the distance, and then pull up, mount the gun, stay focused on the target, not stopping to look and aim at the bead and pull the trigger and see where your pattern hits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you might learn that you're mounting the gun a little bit lower than when you aim it, and so that it ends up shooting higher. And so those are things to know. It might help you correct some things in your form that you're shooting, or it helps you just accommodate that.
Yeah.
That you might have to float the target above your bead when you're out there hunting, and those are things that you can learn. But you only learn those by seeing where your gun actually hits on a patterning board.
That's a great point too, and kind of to add to that is every shotgun does shoot in a different location. So knowing where your point of aim and point of impact is critical in that, you know, does my gun shoot high? Does it shoot low? Does it shoot a little bit, you know, one way or the other, that you don't learn unless you take the time to shoot it from a rest.
I thought it'd be great if we could come up with like a drone and then hang like a paper target below it and have the drone fly by. So we actually have to practice the lead or come up with some sort of shooting event where the targets went by. I think we'd all be pretty surprised like where you're hitting the target. You know, I got to go sea duck hunting one time and they're flying low and they're flying along the water. And it was pretty humbling.
Yeah,
because you realize you're about 4 yards back from the bird. So it helps you correct. But I think most people shoot, you know, behind. I really do. So I lean towards, when we talk about shell selection, I usually lean a little towards faster shells, but
sure,
it all comes with practice. And, you know, like you said, we all talk about patterning, but it just seems like it's rarely practiced as effectively or as much as it should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and well, one load, your lead load may be different from your steel load.
Sure.
So you should try both.
Yeah. I didn't see the drone thing on the tour today, so maybe next time.
We gotta figure that out. We are in the city limits of Anoka, Grand Rapids, this might be an offsite team building event sometime. But
Adam, Dan brings up an interesting point. Maybe we got an analogy for this. Is there a standard for, let's say, you increase or decrease in 100 feet per second velocity? Is that going to, you know, with respect to the timing that pellet is going to get to a certain spot as it translates to lead? And I'm saying this kind of facetiously because we've talked about, I just interviewed Andy Duffy on wing shooting. And really, when we're talking upland hunting, upland birds, look at the target, mount your gun and shoot. You know, don't be thinking about sustained lead and that kind of stuff, specifically with upland hunting. But from your perspective as the, you know, the engineer, like, are there some standards there
as far as distant leads and distances and that type of stuff?
Yeah. And like what you gain or lose with a certain velocity.
I mean, I don't think there's any, you know, exact science to it. It's going to depend on how far away is the bird, how fast is the bird flying? What type of bird is it? What's your payload, velocity, et cetera. I mean, I guess the one thing that's, there's common sense, and so it's probably not worth saying, but, you know, the faster the load, the less lead you're going to need.
Correct.
But as far as, you know, calculating that lead versus the matrix would get so large that, I don't know, it'd be a little bit mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You know, no bird velocity and distance and direction and angle and, you know, payloads and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I know I shoot better when I'm reacting more than that I've missed two and have to go try to get that third one on a duck, you know, and I usually blow that one too, because now I'm way overthinking it, you know.
Yep.
But yeah, so I think you're right. Like, point and shoot and you get a feel for what you're doing.
Yeah. Both of the shooting instructors we've had on here, you know, I think they both had a different way of saying it, but essentially the bird that you're most likely going to kill is the one that surprises you and you don't have enough time. You know, it's okay to have a little bit of time to think. You know, like, I was having a beer with a buddy last night and was kind of saying there's this perfect sweet spot where you got just enough heads up, you know, to hear or see the bird in the air, but then you're shooting. You know, you don't have any more time to overthink it. And as Andy Duffy said, ride it like a pony and shoot behind it or way out in front of it kind of thing.
If you see a lot of experienced sporting clay shooters, and I've shot with a few, sometimes you have that real long target that starts a long ways away and you have to wait for it to get to you, you know, and what I've heard them say is let that target develop, and you'll notice they're not mounting their gun. They're not pointing at it. They're waiting until it's getting to about, you know, if it's a target you want to break at 35 yards, they're waiting until it's at 45 yards and they're pulling up mounting and shooting. They're not riding that target because, I mean, you either have to be a really good shooter or a really bad shooter to ride a target a long time and break it.
Yeah.
So in all likelihood, you're probably a really bad shooter. So,
Do you guys look at shot string at all?
Yeah, we do. We've done quite a bit of work on shot string and correlating it to patterns and shot type, pellet size. So, you know, how we typically do that actually is with high-speed photography and measuring that as it passes by the camera. You know, just general rules of thumb, maybe again, sounds kind of common sense, but the larger the shot size, the shorter the shot string, the less the pellets, you know, have a tendency to slow down, so the closer they stay to one another. Yeah, and then as far as, you know, pattern density, I think there's maybe some correlations to be had there between shorter shot strings and more dense patterns, too. As you think out, like a 410, again, is going to be one of the worst ones for shot string length, just in that starting shape, big L over D, and then low efficiency. So it's some people like to use, like, the drafting or the NASCAR analogy of, like, you know, the pellets that are, you know, when they're tightly together, they can kind of draft behind one another. Well, you know, it's got such a small diameter in 410 that there's not much room for pellets to draft, and they can kind of get away from each other and scatter off course. But yeah, we definitely have looked at all sorts of things as far as patterns go.
So that was almost where I was kind of going when I was asking you about the velocity of different shots and raising or lowering it. But and maybe you can't answer this question, but typical upland ranges, let's say 40 yards and less, just for the sake of discussion, does shot string matter?
Not that we can prove.
Okay.
Yeah. You're all well within one grouse of angle.
Yeah. If you think of the time lapse from the first pellet to the last pellet, it is fractions of a second.
And that's exactly my question. So yeah, that's why I figure we ask the experts here. And right, every gun is different, every shot is different, you know, there's lots of variables that go into that.
We set specs on velocity, we set pattern density specs, we've studied, you know, shot string, but we don't have a specification.
Sure.
So. Yeah, and there's guys that'll tell you, well, you want a long shot string because then you have the opportunity for that bird to fly into your back pellet or or whatever it is, but in my mind, if I had the ideal shotgun shell, it would be every one of my pellets hits the pattern at one time. Yeah, that way I have, you know, I have a 30-inch circle covered in pellets that all hit instantaneously, and I know that my bird's going to fall within that, and I don't have gaps within my pattern.
So very few people miss a bird ahead of it. I mean, it happens.
Yep.
And sure, it might be a little more forgiving because if you're shooting ahead of it and it's the tail end of the string that the bird flies into, you're hitting the bird in the head and you're killing it.
Yep.
You know, it's that most people are shooting behind a bird, and so then if you're shooting behind it and the front end of your string is what hits it, you're hitting it in the rear end and it's getting away. So so more important to the shot string is where on the bird you're hitting it. So in that case, so if you're missing a lot, lead them more.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can kind of always point back to, you know, typically we're missing by feet, not inches. So on the pattern density, we were talking about that a little bit. Given that, you know, 100% efficiency, aka every pellet in a 30-inch circle at 40 yards, that would be our goal. Yeah. What's a good standard? What do you look for?
Yeah, so if it's you know, a target application or, you know, your typical clay load, you're looking for 75% or better. And that would be with like a full choke.
Yeah.
That's pretty standard. You'll see across, you know, the industry what people are doing, kind of thing. If you're getting into larger shot sizes and steel loads, you're, you know, say a double B steel, 1.25 ounces, you're hoping for above 80. There's less pellets in that payload. You want to put as many in that 30-inch circle as possible. If you're a turkey guy and you're shooting a TSS load, you better have all your pellets in that 30-inch circle, and you better have 60% of them in a 10-inch circle, actually. So, it depends on the load, but Sammy does have some kind of, like, you know, predetermined, like, minimums, and but 75% for target loads and game loads, that type of stuff is pretty common, and up from there.
Cool. You know where you guys should do your product development and research is on internet forums.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys on there, a lot of guys and girls on internet forums. They know a lot about shotgun shooting.
They do. I've joked. I do go to forums and I read them. I could probably spend my life on there if I wanted my research. I've often wanted to go on and be like, I am the guy who ruined your shotgun shell because we did this, you know.
Yeah.
But there is, and it's it's hard to, you know, we try to put as much information out there as you can, but then sometimes when you do, people just don't believe you, you know.
Right.
Anyway, but it is a good source, but it is a rabbit hole you can get stuck on.
Yes. For sure. Yeah. I have learned a lot. You got to learn how to weed through a little bit, but absolutely a lot can be learned. And I was telling Jared this, and I think you guys earlier, that I was on one of my favorite Upland internet forums, Upland Journal, and somebody was talking about I don't know if it's a new load. You guys can answer. The Top Gun was for sale at his local Walmart in 28-gauge for $6.97 a box, which is a darn good price on 28-gauge ammo. Is that a new load?
Yeah, new for this year. We have our president, Jason Vanderbrink, is a very passionate. He's a good skeet shooter.
Okay.
And he's a very passionate sub-gauge guy. So he challenged us. He said, we need a better and more affordable 28-gauge 410 load for the market, and you guys need it. And he gave us a cost target, and we went after it, and we hit it. So, but part of that was by doing that, by hitting that price, really enticed like someone like Walmart. They really wanted to bring it in. So, our goal was, and his goal was, to try to grow sub gauge hunting, kind of like what we have been doing with turkey hunting. So, that is new for this year. We did 28 gauge and 410 loads going at 1,330 feet per second, three-quarter ounce loads, if I remember right.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. Yeah. 7.5, 8s, and 9s in both.
I'm excited.
Yeah, and they say they're Top Gun Sporting is what they're called, but they'll make a fine grouse load any day of the week.
Yeah. So. And now, would that be in every Walmart or?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much.
Pretty much. Yeah. Cool. Every Walmart that carries ammo, I believe, would be part of their deal. But we've sold it to our whole customer base too.
Gotcha. So you could find it at other places as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. Excellent. Anything else, guys? I think we're coming up on time. Ryan, any final thoughts?
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to come. I'm looking, please tell the stories about this factory. I'm pretty proud of this factory. I'm second generation. My dad worked 40 years out in that factory building shotgun shell primers. That's what enabled me to go off to college and get a degree in biology and eventually come back here. You hear a lot of stories about families, and I grew up with them. You know, there's families that this is where they work. This is the family place. Yes, we're a big ammunition manufacturer, but there's a lot of pride in this community for the products that we make. I have the Anoka City Council in here all the time, the local politicians, and they're so proud because I had one where he had gone off to Europe on vacation, and he found a sporting goods store, and he went in there, and there was Federal ammunition on the shelf in, I believe it was France, and it said made in Anoka. We're exporting, this community and things all over the country, and there's pride there. And I think we're pretty proud of our opportunities that we provide for women and kids to get into the sport. We think that that's important for the future. Our commitment to conservation is second to none in this industry. And mostly we just hope people shoot them up because we'll make more.
I can say this because I'm a Minnesotan born and raised, but as I walked around the factory today, I saw a bunch of hardworking Minnesotan people making ammunition that's going to be shot by outdoorsmen and women and target shooters and everybody, all across your distribution network. And again, I'm obviously biased, but I take a little bit of pride in that, and obviously you do as well. So, Adam?
I guess just my final thoughts or whatever would be get out, enjoy the outdoors, have fun shooting. It's a great opportunity to have camaraderie, whether you're hunting or just shooting for fun with your friends or family. Enjoy what you're doing, and hopefully you're shooting Federal.
Yeah, and just to capitalize on what Ryan said, it's a cliche, but if you love what you do, it's not a job. I would say all of us in this room probably say we get paid to play a lot. Mm-hmm. And there's stressful days. It's like any other work, but I've been able to work for this company for 10 years, work in the industry for about 15, and I get to sell ammo and develop new products and shot cartridges that might never see the light of day. So it's fantastic. And I always try to reiterate to people when we talk to you, whether you're out in the plant, whatever your job is for this company, we're not selling, 30-06 rounds and 12-gauge shot shells. We're selling, a limit of quail, and we're selling trophy deer, and we're selling championships, So that's the hopes and dreams and the experience we're putting out there. So, Yeah, it's a great place to work. Like you said, ton of pride, and we just love it. So,
excellent. Well, I would like to personally thank all three of you for joining us on the Project Upland podcast. This has been a lot of fun. We talked about some interesting stuff, and I'm sure people will have more questions. Generally speaking, if they want more information or got questions about federal products, where should they go? Who should they contact?
If you go to our website, you can go to federalpremium.com, and there's a reach out to us or contact us. We're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook. Those are probably the major ways, and we got people on there 24/7 monitoring. So a lot of those questions actually filter their way to all of us to answer sometimes. So
the best way to get to me is on Twitter. I'm at Hunters for Conservation. So okay. Hunters for Conservation is a federal premium trademark, and that's the best way to get a hold of the conservation program in the company. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. All right. That about does it for us. Jared, I know we weren't featuring you on the podcast today, but thank you for joining us here. And just a heads up for the Project Upland listeners, they'll be hearing a little bit more from Federal and Jared later this year. We got some plans this fall hunting season. So excited about that. Again, guys, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Project Upland podcast. Thank you to Federal Ammunition. We're done.
You've been listening to the Project Upland podcast. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. And a reminder that this podcast was brought to you by Pine Ridge Grouse Camp, Dogtra Callers, Yukonuba Dog Food, Gordian Sons Outfitters, and Dakota 283 Kennels. Find more podcasts, articles, films, and much more at projectupland.com. Thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Project Upland podcast.
This is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.